Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, I mean, just with this group, I have to share this extremely quickly. You've read the New Yorker magazine over the years, right? And there is that leitmotif, that cartoon that keeps showing up, where you climb to the top of the Himalayas and there's the wise man in the beard who lives in the cave, who then shares the wisdom. So I got to tell you this, in your line of work. I just knew that when this happened, if I ever had this opportunity, I would share it with you. We were working on, you know, we hit the climate change story pretty hard with our show quite regularly. Bigger projects was to go to the source of the Ganges, no less than the Ganges River, which is the Gangotri Glacier, high up the Himalayas, about 6 miles from, 6 kilometers from the Chinese border. Climate scientists tell us it's eroding due in large part to climate change. If the Gangotri Glacier ever disappears, and the predictions are just a couple decades that will happen, it could mean the Ganges becomes a seasonal river. And could you imagine what that does to agriculture downstream? So we tied that into food security and water issues and then brought it back around to the American West, and that was our show. So it's a climb to get up there to the Gangotri Glacier. And, you know, I show up kitted out with all the best that L.L. Bean has to offer. And then the pilgrims clad in saffron robes and flip-flops just blasting past you on the trail. And it wasn't good enough. I was with a famous mountain climber, Conrad Anker, and so he had to go further. So we got on the glacier, crossed it, and went up to this magical alpine meadow that overlooks the glacier at 15,000 feet. And there's like one person who lives there. And it is the wise person, like from the New Yorker cartoon. But none of you will be surprised to learn, but I think you'll be delighted to realize it's not a guy with a beard, it's a woman. Of course the wise person at the top of the world is a woman. Mata Bhakti Priyananda, I think that means she who loves devotion. She's Indian, but she spoke American-accented English. I asked why. She had a master's in special ed from Northern Illinois State. Didn't expect that. But she prays, and she writes her prayers out to the point that there was a cluster of empty pen refills in front of her from all the writing out of her prayers. And she asked what we were doing. She says, "Why is it your problem, my glacier?" And I said, "Well, argument is that we're part of the actual problem. We are not the only problem, but we Americans are part of this problem." She took that on. She considered that. And then she said this. This is why I'm telling you this little yarn. She said this. It's on tape. I'm not making this up. She said, "Listen, if you make your film, you go home, you show it, and people watch it and shrug and move on, you haven't done very much, have you?" She said, "However, if people are moved by these images that you bring back to action, then," essentially she said, "your quest is worthy, my son." So we included a little bit of that in our piece. It's online if ever you're caffeinated and bored. It's called On Thin Ice. But, it's something all of us in this line of work need to be reminded that although we don't prescribe the way forward, we don't say vote for this candidate, this particular policy is the way to go, we do want our readers, viewers, listeners to run with what we supply them. So the format for this thing is Jeannie McCarthy is very patiently sitting here. I'm about to introduce her. We're going to do kind of a Jimmy Kimmel, Craig Ferguson thing. Okay? And then I'm very serious about your questions, but I'm also very serious about that they be questions. 50 questions get rewarded, and we'll do that. And then there'll be sort of a commercial break, but stick around. Maybe we'll do a little stretch or something, and then we'll get to part two, and it'll be a similar format. So put on the glasses, which you never see on television. So how would you like to be in charge of the air? Jeannie McCarthy has that responsibility for the air, which means for the air that we breathe, for the air where all that carbon dioxide scientists are worried about is going. For 25 years, Ms. McCarthy has worked at state and local levels on environmental issues, including the top post at the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection. She has hands-on experience at what's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, that is cap and trade, not theoretical on paper, but in practice, but in the here and now. And let's all welcome the Chief of Air and Radiation at EPA, Assistant EPA Administrator Jeannie McCarthy.
Thank you, David.
So what's the plan If Congress doesn't regulate CO2, EPA will, for the biggest emitters.
Well, the plan is to help support Congress get a comprehensive cap and trade bill. But the plan is not to wait around and wait for that to happen and dream. It's to provide technical assistance and support for it. But the plan is also to move forward. We have laws that we're going to abide by. And one of those laws tells us that we have to manage pollution. And one of the first things that the Obama administration is to take on the issue of CO2 by looking at what they call the endangerment finding. And the endangerment finding is really two questions in one. The first question is, are these man-made pollutants that we're spewing out, called greenhouse gases, a danger to public health and safety? And if they are cars contributing? The proposed answer was yes and yes. And the final answer will be coming out soon. I feel like I was on the, I want to be a millionaire or something. The final answer is, I'm not going to say what that is, because that's not my call. But it will be coming out soon, and if the answer to that question remains yes and yes, that means that it's a regulated pollutant and we're going to regulate it. And we've already anticipated that that may be the case by putting out another regulation, and that would be to define how we're going to begin to look at new and major modifications of stationary facilities like power plants or large industries that generate significant amounts of CO2, and we're going to begin to require really good technologies on those facilities, from energy efficiency to control technologies.
Now, you've heard the line, right? So you're going to do this to every Dunkin' Donuts and cow that produces CO2, every flatulent cow?
I am personally going to do that, yes.
Yeah.
And we're going to make that first announcement in Wisconsin. What a public relations strategy that would be.
It's the bigger ones, right?
Yes, it's 25,000 tons annually. And that would be really the industries that we normally regulate, not the ones that are familiar with us enough to hate us already, rather than a new breed of people to hate us.
But you started by saying you'd prefer, or at least the plan, yeah, is legislation. Why is legislation better than just you guys doing your thing?
Well, I try to explain it's not legislation or regulation, because even the legislation that's been proposed requires EPA to regulate. It's just we honestly believe that a cap-and-trade system for the larger industries and for the refineries and the production companies are the better way to approach it. I firmly believe it personally. I was involved in the development of a cap-and-trade program. I think it's an ingenious way to sort of innovate change, to keep costs down, and to allow a market-based system to really move the reductions forward that you're trying to achieve.
Let's talk about that, because you are the person that you'd want to any of us would want to reach out to on that issue of cap and trade. I mean, they've been trying it in Europe to mixed success. I mean, does it really work?
Yeah, I think it does, and I think it can work. I think it's a design challenge, and it's an implementation challenge. But I think one of the things we tried to do, I know when we were looking at a cap and trade program in the Northeast, which is what I was most intimately involved in, you know, we saw what happened in the first round in Europe, and we didn't make the same mistakes. And the more that the Europeans continue and you learn from their lessons and you can design it, you can design it any way you want, but you can really establish use a cap and trade program to define the result you're looking for and to find the most creative way to get there.
This is a pretty up to speed audience, mm-hmm. So you could drill down a little bit. Like, what's a mistake the Europeans made that we shouldn't repeat?
They gave too many allowances out.
Really?
That wasn't too tough. Anybody disagree with that? Basically, they made them so cheap that you could get them anywhere and you weren't driving the reductions. And that's, I think, the biggest challenge, is to look at what your cap is going to be, look at how you drive that down. I know that there is differences between the Senate and the House on how they're going to do allowances. But the key is how many allowances you give out and how you use that and a combination of offsets to control cost. I think offsets is going to be one of the trickiest pieces of any cap and trade program, because it's great to do offsets because it allows you a lot more flexibility and it allows you, it's a great cost containment mechanism. But if they're not sound and they're not verified and they're not credible and they're not permanent, then you don't have a cap. And that's going to be one of EPA's major challenges, is to help manage that offset program.
Here, I promised that everybody's so up to speed, but actually, help me understand the offsets
a
little bit.
Well, you told me they'd know these things.
I know. Well, I didn't, though. But help me with offsets a little bit.
Yep.
How do they work?
An offset is a reduction that's outside of the cap. So basically, there's a couple of ways in which you can meet reductions under a cap. You can have an allowance, which is basically equal to a ton of emissions. Those allowances are generated within the cap. And if I get an allowance, that means I can emit a ton. And so you have just a certain number of those. That's what controls how many tons can be emitted among the cap sources. But if you emit more than the allowances you have, offsets are created as a mechanism to allow you to invest in greenhouse gas reductions outside of those capped areas and actually gain what is in essence a ton of emissions or excess allowances. So basically, if it's cheaper to do some offsets through forestation in Brazil, I have a choice of doing that as opposed to buying an allowance. And most of the time, cap and trades are designed so that the majority of the reductions you need to achieve are within the cap, but it allows that as a small portion outside as a cost mitigation in case the allowances get very expensive.
And we'll talk more to Secretary Vilsack about this in a second, but as you mentioned, we are in Wisconsin, and there is a lot of farmland, and there are some farmers quite interested in the notion of being an offset.
And we are kind of interested in the notion that they are offsets. Really, I think that's the one area in which Administrator Jackson and Secretary Vilsack have worked very closely together, is I see that there is an alliance in the issue between the agriculture community and greenhouse gas reductions. Yes, they are concerned that we're going to do something about taxing cows or do something about reducing the emissions from cows. That's simply not going to happen. And so we really do want the agriculture community to focus on greenhouse gases in a different way and in a way that would benefit agriculture. And we think there are really opportunities within a cap and trade program, the one that would be designed in legislation to have offsets that would reward farmers for doing the types of agriculture you want for land preservation those types of farming practices that would really be beneficial from a greenhouse gas reduction perspective.
We're going to prime the audience to start coming up to ask some of their own questions. Same ground rules as the other sessions. Please say your name. You could share your affiliation if you like. We're looking for questions, pithy ones. But while people mobilize for that, you're raring to go with the power to regulate CO2 as a pollutant. But there are those in industry who think that they're going to sue you and slow you down. Is that really going to tie your hands, the legal system?
Oh, I think they are going to sue.
Yeah.
I think that we've seen that. I don't think we've had a major air regulation go out that we weren't sued by quite a number. It's become standard operating practice. It doesn't mean you don't move forward, and it doesn't mean you can't move forward. We're in the process right now of redoing 23 rules that were handed back to us from the courts that were done in the prior administration that didn't pass legal muster. So our rules of the road now are, if I'm going to put out a regulation, I can expect to be sued, but that regulation is going to be faithful to the law and faithful to science, and we will live with the consequences of that and move it forward. But we think we'll prevail. It may get delayed, but we're going to win.
First question over here. Tell us your name, if you would.
Hello, my name is Gloria Gonzalez. I'm with Environmental Finance Magazine. Two questions, really. I'm wondering if you could comment on the 25,000-ton threshold and how you arrived at that figure. Mm-hmm. And also, if you could give some insight on how you view how well the REGI program has worked, particularly taking into account the recent drop in prices in the REGI program.
Let's start with that one. What is that?
Which one?
REGI.
Oh, REGI is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. It's basically a 10-state cap-and-trade program that was established in the Northeast. The reason why the Northeast states went forward with it was to show that you could do a cap-and-trade program for greenhouse gases. It's not as aggressive in terms of the reductions it's looking for as you would want for a national program, but it has all the pieces in place. We actually auctioned more than 70% of the allowances. And we designed it very carefully so that it didn't have a significant impact on energy prices. So I think I'm pretty proud of it. It was done pretty well. Reggie worked absolutely as designed. And it worked as designed because where it was a regional program and there was significant question about whether or not a regional program could be aggressive enough without being a significant cost problem for the region where nobody else was doing it and create what we call leakage, which is basically you get energy generated outside of the cap that becomes more competitive and then enters into the market. Those were all constraints in terms of how it was designed, but it was designed the way we anticipated it. It was one of the nicest things to be able to go over and argue to the legislature that the cost of allowances would be somewhere between $3 and $5, and they actually ended up that way. So that's where they've been. Recently, they have gone down. The most recent auction had the price somewhere, I think, a little bit above $2, some $2.20 or something like that. Is that what it was? Something like that. I think that's just attributable to the fact that the economy is not driving a lot of energy generation. And the good news is you have cleaner air as a result of that because you have less pollution, but there's also less demand for the allowances. But over time, that will adjust itself. We expect that will go up and go down. That's how markets work. And so I don't think it's an indication of a problem with the program. Now, your second question was the $25,000. Now, is the $25,000 in the legislation or in our regulation? Okay. We most recently, the Administrator Jackson announced a regulation that was proposed by EPA just last week. And that is basically a regulation to begin to require best available control technologies on new facilities that are being constructed that emit an estimated more than 25,000 tons a year. That amount was, I don't think it was an accident in any way. We took a look at it. It aligns very closely with other large facilities that are in the system. So if you look at the 25,000 level, it's about 14,000 facilities across the country. It's 11,000 facilities that we already regulate in one way or another, types of facilities, so we know that they're familiar with what we do and what they would need to do for the program. It also brings in a lot of landfill, methane gas programs and other things, but it does eliminate what we believe are the vast majority of small sources that that don't really amount to a lot. In that 25,000, we capture about 85% of the greenhouse gases being emitted. We thought it was a reasonable amount to begin to regulate. They know what they're doing. We know how to manage those facilities, and so we're going to move it forward.
Question here. Tell us your name.
I'm Dave Tenenbaum. I write for the Y Files. The question is, in cap and trade, you've just told us you're going to monitor, you're going to make sure that the offsets are legitimate. And my question is, given that the science is so young on the flow of carbon through the air and into the soil and into the crops and into the trees and how long the forest lasts, there are really a lot of unknowns. So are you planning on sending forest inspectors and farm inspectors to Indonesia and Brazil and Wisconsin to figure out, and year after year to figure out if those offsets are legitimate?
It's my new retirement package. That's what I'm going to be sending myself. You're asking, and I don't mean to make light of it, it's a very serious question. The legislation that's been proposed both in the House and Senate looks to rely on third-party verifiers that EPA would basically manage and audit. I think what we decided to do in the REGGIE program, which I imagine will be how it gets laid out in any federal cap and trade program, is you begin with categories of offsets that you're very sure about. And you define exact protocols for how you would count those, and then you train third-party verifiers, and then you audit those verifiers. We found in REGGIE that there are a number of offsets that are very easy to manage. Landfill gas methane projects. Now, that's countable, it's verifiable, we can figure that out. So you have to start building this audit and verification program with things that you know well how to do, and then continue to get more sophisticated over time, and I assume that's how it will lay out.
Sir, tell us your name.
Art Hackett, Wisconsin Public Television. A few moments ago, a gentleman from the Canadian Petroleum Producers was talking about cap and trade and said we can live with it. We wish we would have a price set on carbon, then we can make our, you know, make our plans. But he said we personally would rather have a carbon tax, simpler, cleaner, don't have to weigh power plants versus oil refineries. It's just all carbon is carbon. Would you prefer personally an energy tax, a carbon tax, as opposed to cap and trade? And do you think we're going to eventually wind up having to go with that because cap and trade isn't going to work out?
I will answer that in two ways. One is that the administration would clearly not prefer a carbon tax. And secondly, my personal opinion doesn't matter. How about that? But I'll answer it a third way. I actually agree with the administration. I do not like a carbon tax because it is indiscriminate in terms of who has to pay for it. And you can't assure the reductions you're going to achieve. And this country would never make it high enough to make it worthwhile.
Oh, it's a very interesting point. We just had.
We don't value environmental improvements very highly in terms of a tax structure. That's just my personal opinion.
It was interesting. I did.
And I'm going to shut up now.
Before you get too far down that line. Sir, tell us, this will be the last question of this session. Tell us your name.
My name is Mark Schlefstein, and I'm a reporter with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. The toxics release inventory, when it first came out, had a dramatic effect on chemical emissions in this country. Almost overnight, within 5 years, there were major reductions. The carbon release inventory that's been proposed, have y'all made any estimates based on the TRI success of how successful you think that will be in reducing emissions? And how are you preparing a public relations campaign or some other campaign to get the media to do what they did with the TRI, list the top 10 in every state and things like that?
That's a really excellent question. We have taken other concrete steps beyond the endangerment finding. We're moving forward on the greenhouse gas tailpipe standard, which California was pushing and is now going to be a national program. But the other thing we did was just a few weeks ago, we finalized a rule for reporting of greenhouse gases. It's called the Mandatory Reporting Rule. And again, that's for the larger facilities, the 25,000 and over. That is going to provide us information on really over 80% of the greenhouse gases that are being emitted. And I'm hoping it will have the exact same effect as the toxic release inventory and be actually even more successful. We're just beginning to have do the outreach related to that because what we are doing is collecting information in 2010 that will be released in early 2010. It'll be released in early 2011. That's the first year of data that will be publicly available. We're working very hard to make sure that that data is publicly available almost when it's submitted. We're electronically going to collect it. We're going to do some QA/QC, and we're going to bounce it out. Now, I think I couldn't agree more on the TRI issue, which is basically every company reduced their chemical use in their waste generation because they didn't want to be on that list. Now, I believe you will see the same effect with the reporting rule on greenhouse gases because you'll now be able to see how much greenhouse gases are being emitted by different facilities in your community, and you'll be able to report on that, and I hope you will. But the reason why I think it will be even more successful is every time you emit a greenhouse gas as an industry, you are throwing money out the door because it means that you are being inefficient because it is a result of fossil fuel burning that's blown out your window and it's worth money to stop it. So I don't think that we'll just be relying on the good work of the press, which I hope you do, but we'll also be relying on people who own these companies to take a look at it and say, oh, my God, look at the money that I could be saving with a little bit of energy efficiency. And so I think that that reporting rule will have enormous value, and we're going to make sure that we do significant outreach on it so that people know it's happening and can spread the word.
Assistant EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy, thank you very much.
David, thank you very much.
wonderful. Thank you.